Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Today we are speaking to Mark Rainey on the importance of reading Capital, particularly volumes 2 and 3, and how it relates to larger Marxist political economic understanding.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today we're going to talk to a friend of the podcast and former Herding Cats reading group member, Mark Rainey. And we're talking to Mark about Capital's volume 2 and 3, because everyone stops at volume 1. Everybody. And I saw the writer for Cold Dark Stars asked the rather provocative question, why are people so obsessed with long and repetitive books like Capital? And Cold Dark Stars' Amir is a fairly serious socialist thinker, and I wanted to really get into that because I've been going through a project with my non-Zero Books-related podcast, Emancipation, on reading Andrew Kleiman's...
Rethinking Capital.
No, Reclaiming Marxist Capital. Yeah. Which is fairly orthodox, although primarily deals with logic and math problems, and basically says, the very shorthand is, Capital isn't inconsistent, shut up. It's actually much more complicated than that, and it gets into obscure academic battles. And I think, having gone through this obscure academic battle process myself lately, I realize how alienating that is to even fairly committed socialists. So, Mark, you've been making the pitch on all your social media. You're no longer on Facebook, but when you were on Facebook, this was a regular topic of conversation, is shut up and actually do the economics and read the stuff. Right? Get your categories straight, deal with it. Why do you think that's so important, and why have you been pulled that way? Because you've gotten a lot of resistance for that stance.
A whole lot. More than I expected. And I kind of had this like idea to where I would read this book and, you know, my comrades at home and, you know, friends would have been like, oh shit, he did it. You know, like, let's hear what he has to say. But instead it was more of a, you know, don't gatekeep this, like, socialism isn't just, you know, what Marx had to say, and he wrote it a long time ago anyway, so it's probably not even valid anymore. And
but how would they know?
Yeah, that's what I said, is, you know, it's like, well, let's just give it a chance and read it. And I got to that point because just a long string of failures. I started organizing as a new leftist back in 2010. 2011 with Socialist Alternative, and we had a whole lot of energy and, you know, passion. But
this was right after the Sawant victory, right?
Before Sawant, we were in the middle of all of the fundraising and campaigning for her, and a bunch of us went to Seattle to help with that. I didn't, but you know, we were very enthusiastic. We had a couple of early successes with protests. We had about 300 people show up for an early Black Lives Matter protest before it was called Black Lives Matter. And, you know, we got drunk on it. And after a while, we all burnt out, you know.
You sound like me in 1998 to 2002, by the way.
Yeah.
Like I did the same thing, but way earlier.
Right.
And not with Marxists, because, like, Marxism, while not technically dead, was pretty dead in the 90s. I came to the same thing. Like, I did this, except I went through, like, a longer period in the wilderness, it sounds like, than you, that was, like, 6 years, three of which I was kind of a reactionary, like, outright. And then the housing, then I was doing some reading and like 2005, realizing that we were heading on some kind of housing bubble, because housing stock didn't make sense to me, and neither did the loan instruments. And I read a bunch of Austrian economics, and then I read a bunch of Marxist economics, and the Marxist economics explain stuff better. I mean, as weirdly as that sounds, I mean, that's pretty much the way it came out. And I eventually worked my way through Capital. I was encouraged at first by David Harvey, I think right before Occupy, when he started doing his series, to go back and, like, really try to read it. Like, I've read Capital Volume 1 like everybody else. But I really tried to read it again. And then I found myself first, you know, going off of David Harvey and then, like, disagreeing with him on the interpretation. So you got drunk on it. You felt like there was a lot of failures. Before we get into the hard questions of the relevance, make a pitch. Why should I, activist campaigning cadre member of some organization, be it the DSA, the SA, the ISO, Freedom Road Socialist Organization, any of those, why should I care about almost 200-year-old critiques of bourgeois economic theory?
You know, there's a bunch of different ways to come about it. The way that I came about it personally was I got involved with a group that called themselves Marxists, and the idea of a scientific understanding of socialism appealed to me. I'm trained as a geologist, so I like science. And, you know, the more I participated, the less amount of attention I actually paid to the scientific aspect of it or any empirical glances at how these things are actually working. So I got all the catchphrases and, you know, I learned how to do the street preaching and stuff. And, you know, whenever people would give me simple rebuttals to the ideas, I didn't know how to answer them. And I saw you either just double down on an almost religious, you know, belief in socialism is going to happen because the working class are going to save us. And, or you just have to sort of take a step back and sort of pack away your excitement and your passion and dig in for the long haul and really try to figure out what you know and what you don't know and what you can learn. And going into volume one and finishing it, I thought that I'd pretty much figured it out. You know, I was a Marxist at that point. And then going into volumes two and three, you know, you just learned that there's so much more to the analysis and all of the catchphrases that came from it. And eventually that analysis gets lost in the catchphrase and it takes on just sort of its own meaning. I don't know.
Are you familiar with the philosopher of science, Emmy Lakatos?
No, I'm not. The name sounds familiar, but I haven't.
The person who theorized, he was a student of Karl Popper. He was also at one point in his life a Stalinist and was always kind of hedging his bets on whether or not he was anti-Marxist or not. He says a lot of anti-Marxist-y things, but he's actually very soft on Hegel and Marx themselves. He just talks about all the predictive claims that Marxism got wrong. Official Marxism. And I started working through him, and I came to this thing that our use of what is originally technical jargon as, like, rhetorical in-group agitprop propaganda is really damaging to understanding what the technical jargon originally meant. Because when we use it as like, you know, you call it the keywords, right? Or the you know, all the buzzwords that you hear in Marxism. When you use it that way, you can get very like, oh, classes, whatever. Like, try to ask someone. And also, you and I could talk about this. Marx doesn't actually technically ever define working class. He does define proletariat in a footnote that was excised. Like, and that's not even in the Capital. Marx doesn't, as when you read the analysis of 1, 2, and 3, I'm going to make this, like, easy for you in a sense, but I kind of want you to respond to this. Marx is really interesting because, kind of like Hegel, he doesn't use axiomatic definitions, like, and this is not like modern science, right? He doesn't state his definition first. He might define like a part of something, but any key concept he's not going to define. He's going to describe how it actually works and then let you deduce what the operant definition means, which is great for being a materialist, you know, a materialist analysis of history. It's terrible for trying to like get people to really get stuff in a simple way, because I can't be like, this is what Marx defined working class as, or this is what, I think the only thing I can really do that is, this is what a commodity is. And even that's like a 4-page definition. That's more description than axiom.
So yeah, I think that that's actually a strength of Marx's.
Oh, I do too, but it makes it very difficult to teach it simply.
Yeah. I don't know if there is a way to teach it simply, because it's not simple. It's is very abstract, and most people have no way to connect with how a market works or how production works, because we're just not involved in it. You know, it's like we don't have any real way to watch it happen. And I'll find myself reading something and thinking, okay, that makes sense. But then when I actually think about, like, how does this actually look in real life, I have no idea. And I'll go on a rabbit hole trying to figure out, you know, what a bank discount is or something like that, for example. And, you know, with the class definition, I think that one thing that Marx points out about a capitalist, mm-hmm. as in an actual person, is that it's not so much about the person as it is about the capital that they represent on the market. So it's like, you know, do you have, in that sense, do you actually have to define what a capitalist is, or do you just have to kind of say, you know, capital has these compulsions due to the social relations that it's built out of, and there are certain people who are going to be compelled to act for that capital and to represent it, and there's going to be some people that are compelled to be sort of, you know, subsumed to that capital relationship.
But Marx, to be fair to Marx, if this is not in Capital, this is in other writings, he does think that individuals can pretty much do whatever. I'll give you an example of that. When he talks about human nature, he says, like, yeah, human nature is a thing because they're species being. We can't know what it is because we have this instantiation in time and history and whatever. But we also can't know if an individual petty bourgeois person, for example, is going to side with the proletariat or not, because that's an individual choice. Like, an individual can proletarianize, and even like a true bourgeois can proletarianize, right? And that means throw their lot in with this development of the proletariat. I mean, if he didn't believe that, he wouldn't work with Engels. At the same notion, you have to separate that out from, like, what the aggregate of capital does.
Right.
Because we can say things about the aggregate that follow certain laws that we can't actually say about individuals. And this is interesting to me, but I didn't get that until I read a whole lot of Marx, including Capital. Like, he's not talking about individual people. Like not all workers, for example, are going to have good politics just because they're workers.
Right.
And vice versa, you know, they're not going to have bad politics. It's just how they move in aggregate. What do you think was the most surprising thing you learned specifically from Volume 2 and Volume 3? Like, let's make a pitch for those two, because a lot of people get through Capital Volume 1. There's tons of groups. I mean, I think Doug does a Capital Volume 1 group like every 3 years. Like, Doug Lane from Zero Books. And you and I actually began to know each other kind of through that and through something else, the Marxist Center. We won't talk about that. But what do you make of that? Like, why do you think people stop on Volume 1? A lot of people do get through Volume 1, but they stop. And what did you think you got from Volume 2 and 3 that changed your politics or changed the way you understood the economy?
Yeah, there's a general idea that since Volume 1 was the only one that Marx actually finished and edited, that it's the most important one, and the rest are sort of just like afterthoughts that are just rambling notes, I guess. And that's sort of what I thought about, you know, going into it. It's just like, this is going to be like extremely difficult. I felt Volume 1 was fairly difficult. It was
a test
of discipline. It's repetitive. And, you know, and if you think that's true about Volume 1, then good luck on 2 and 3, because it really is
a mess. I mean, 2 in particular,
it's, at least, yeah, it's a test of your perseverance. But at the same time, so much of what we talk about, so much of what socialism could look like, you know, like, that's, he gets into it in Volume 2 and 3 quite a bit, I think, especially with the two department circulation scheme he has, when he starts showing, I think that the thing that really showed me what he was talking about was how the capitalist class, their wealth is socialized and it's almost shared. And that private ownership isn't so much a thing, you know, because of the way that, you know, credit works and the way that the money is passed around from Department 1, which makes the means of production, to Department 2, which does consumable goods. But then you know, the Department II capitalists send that money back over to Department I, so it returns to the original investor. And so, like, the way that the money circulates amongst the capitalists and the way that the working class participates in that circulation process, basically, you know, buying back the goods that we produced, you know, it kind of showed me how capitalism really is a social relation, even if on the ground it seems like I'm an individual trying to make his way through the world. It showed how all of my purchases are sort of connected into a larger system of production and circulation that has to work out in a certain way. It has to equalize eventually, but it can't. And that's because of that anarchy of production. It's like all of these numbers have to match up, all of these purchases and sales have to be made in order for simple reproduction to happen. And the way that we have it set up to do that, it's impossible to ever realize. And I think that that's a strength of that socialists can cling on to. It's like, you know, we already, you know, we produce according to strict limitations because of, you know, you can't produce more means of production than are going to be used because then they'll sit there and depreciate, or you can't produce more consumables than can be consumed because they'll go bad and then that value's gone. So, like, there's already this, like, structure that we have to work within, but there's no conscious way to direct it. And I know that with the financialization that a lot of leftists talk about that happened, there's the idea that there's more planning because of the banks. They're able to choose where they invest and how they invest, and they sit on boards, and there's a lot more control now, but we still can't have the control that we could under socialism, to where we can truly direct, you know, the way that reproduction can happen. And I'm sort of rambling now, but, like, I think that Volume 2 really is important to show how important a planned economy is in comparison to, you know, that the capital relation that currently dictates how we live.
So you're a geologist. I mentioned Amir from Cold Dark Stars earlier. He's an astrophysicist who I think wants to work on climate change. If you were pitching this to the average left liberal, you know, radical, whatever, you know, and you don't want to make appeals to Lenin because every leftist has a Cerulean Lenin cult, ironically, but, like, nobody else is convinced by that, right? That's a Kool-Aid you already have to believe in. And that's not to diminish Lenin, but, you know, you can't go to quote normies, unquote, with that first. But if you were going to talk about, say, this Capitals Volume 2 and 3 and, I don't know, climate change, like, how would you tie this in? And how is it a different answer than what you hear a lot of the time on the left from people who, like, don't theory gatekeep?
Well, I think that, you know, what I was just talking about, the two-department circulation scheme, really, it shows the limits of how much and what we can produce. And if we have it, the current setup to where, you know, capitalists are investing money in the most profitable industries, or, you know, whatever, where they can make the highest buck, you're never going to have the investment in things that aren't profitable. And right now, like, clean technology just isn't profitable. You're not going to make the same amount of money you would if you invested in oil or, you know, coal or whatever. And history has shown that it's impossible to convince the required amount of investors to pull out of their very profitable investments and put them into something that, you know, might not work out, that they might not even believe in, that...
But even if they do believe in, like, I really want to emphasize that enough. Like, let's say Elon Musk really believes in battling climate change. But he's not going to do from a rational planning standpoint, the most efficient, you know, public transportation, even allowing for independent individual autonomy. He's going to try to do that within the already existing, or most of the existing, public infrastructure.
Right. And while still pulling in that socially normal rate of interest, or, you know, rate of profit, or you know, whatever he's looking at. If he's not, if his money, if his capital isn't making more money, if he isn't going from M to M prime, then he's not doing his job. He's not being a capitalist. And, you know, if his M prime isn't as big as it could be, you know, he's still not going to be doing his job.
Yeah, particularly in corporate governments where this is like actually part of the law that you have to be a good capitalist.
Right.
Like
the board can sue you if you're not making the right decisions to make them the best money.
I mean, one of the interesting things about the heroic period of capital, which Marx was writing about, and this is not to like romanticize that period of capital, it's actually far worse in a lot of ways. But an individual capitalist, one individual capitalist could theoretically, you know, go against the current of capital. They're going to eventually go out of business, but they could do it for a while, right? You could even think of someone like Henry Ford, who didn't really go against it entirely, but at least modified it in ways. And they could sustain losses for a while. But capitalism, as we understand the system now, has developed in such a way that it's made that legally almost impossible to do. Now, you wouldn't get that exactly from volumes 2 and 3. But one thing I wanted to talk to you about, you haven't mentioned yet, is volume 2 and 3. Yeah, volume 3 is where you get the law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. And that's super contentious. And I don't really, you know, I believe in it. I think there's empirical evidence for it. But, you know, whatever. We're not going to get into that entirely. But you get a concept that really helps make sense of how we still seem to have profits on a highly productive, you know, manufacturing system like you have in the United States, that where most of the produce physical commodities actually have a very low profit margin. That's not even contested by bourgeois economics. And that's the concept of credit and monopoly capitals. And you don't get that in volume one. And a lot of people use monopoly capital weirdly because they don't use it the way Marx used it in volume 2 and 3. They use it in this later expanded way from Hilferding and Lenin. But this is not to say that's wrong, but it's not exactly the same thing that Marx was talking about.
How would you say that they're different? I'm reading Hilferding right now. So like I've been reading a lot about what he says about finance capital, obviously. I'm on part 5 of 5. And I think maybe in reading this, the distinction between how Marx defines it and how he defines it has sort of gotten mixed, a little muddied. Right,
I'm not entirely sure that there's a strong difference between, say, Hilferding and Marx and maybe even Lenin and Marx. What I am sure is, though, that people who refer to, like, say, imperialism, the highest phase of capitalism, which is a slight mistranslation of the title anyway, are using it in a completely different way. Like, they see monopoly capital as purely state-granted imperialism for quote-unquote mega-profits, I guess an artificially created M prime. You could take this really far, like third worldists do, and actually argue that somehow the state has bought off the bourgeoisie by paying them above their actual value. But if you actually look at productivity levels, that makes absolutely no sense. As a side note, by the way, listeners, this is also an argument for doing real empirical work and going through bourgeois data as opposed to just reciting, you know, what so-and-so said about so-and-so said about so-and-so once. So I'm glad you're reading Hilferding, but I do think they're like monopoly capital in Marx refers to like any grant of patent, you know, like intellectual property, which Marx didn't seem to think intellectual property in general could happen. And we can get into that. But in specific, intellectual property is a form of monopoly capital, right?
Right.
If you look at where there's
talking about that specifically with the rents and stuff, right?
Right. Well, but that's what it is. Like, if you think about what IP actually is, it's a rent system.
Right.
It's not like you don't get the thing. You can't just, it's not truly yours to do whatever you want with. Like, I can't infinitely, like, because I could, like, when you talk about IP, for example, and this is weirdly something libertarians get with Marxists and other people don't get. Like, I can infinitely reproduce an MP3. If I truly own that and it was not a rent extracted system, there's nothing they could do to stop me because it's mine. But I don't truly own it. I only have access to it because the IP is owned by the patent holder or the copyright holder.
Right.
And that changes the commodity relationship a little bit. And I used to ask people, and this is something I got from Volume 2 and Volume 3 too. I used to ask people, well, if you take this and you look at like all these quote on profitable sectors of the economy in the United States, and then you go, why can't other countries do this, right? Why can't they have like highly skilled labor just patent the crap out of everything? And then you look at countries that have successful IP programs, most of them also still have or have had in the form of dead labor, some real manufacturing base to build that off on that still maintains. I mean, in the US, you know, as much as we don't talk about it, it's still the second largest manufacturing power in the world. Like China does outproduce it, but it's just the efficiency levels and the profitability and most traditionally manufactured goods is so low, we don't notice it as part of the economy.
Right.
And that makes total sense if you read volumes 2 and 3. I don't think you could get the tools to make sense of that entirely out of just volume 1.
No, absolutely not. Especially since, you know, leaving volume 1, you're still going to be under the assumption that, you know, value pretty much equals price, and that, you know, the only thing that affects it is the supply and demand surrounding that initial value. But,
well, a whole lot of people seem to think value equals price. And I used to think that was just conservatives. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who said, oh, well, price doesn't work on labor theory of value. But like a whole lot of socialists, including some people who call themselves Marxists, seem to think that value equals price.
I think Paul Cockshott does.
Yeah, most physicalists do, as a side note. I know what a totally lose our listeners who don't know. Hell, our listeners probably don't know mainstream economic jargon. So when I start talking about historical positions that have largely fallen out of favor, that's one of them. Physicalism is popular amongst both Marxist and actually some heterodox who aren't Marxist, and even some classical economists. But that does equal value to price. Now, I could go into why that's not true from both my own reading or from Andrew Kleiman's reading. There's a bunch of ways you can derive that just can't be true. But there are mysteries. I mean, you're the anarchists who know a little bit about this throw at you. Well, commodity didn't come first. That came first. The power relationship came first. What's your answer? What's your tentative answer to that question? I know I didn't prep you for these questions. I don't want to play like gotcha, but...
No, it's fine. So the idea that the power relationship preceded the commodity.
The power relationship, the debt relationship preceded the commodity, not like the bartering thing that Karl Marx pulls from Adam Smith and from Ricardo.
I
don't think it matters. Like, I actually one of those people who's like, so like, how does it change the relationship at all if debt is why commodities were exchanged. Because when you really look at commodity exchange historically, yeah, debt did precede it, but also commodities weren't exchanged within a tribe, right? They were exchanged between tribes, but not within a tribe. You would just share it within your own tribe. Like you're part of a cohesive, you know, social unit that's relatively de-alienated. And I get this from studying anthropology, and, you know, like I'm not an anthropologist. I've been accused of that before, but and so if there's a debt relationship because of their power relationship within the tribe that causes you to produce a commodity, that still doesn't explain, like, so what? Like, that's just like an internal mechanism for why anyone would have done it in the first place. Like, why would you produce by force?
But even so, what are you in debt for if there's not a commodity?
I mean, like,
what I understand the commodity is it's any useful good
that can be traded on a market.
Immediate use is to be traded, is to get rid of it because it's extra and you don't need it anymore. So right. It's just like, if you don't have some sort of excess that you can give away, you know, where does that debt come in give me this, I'm going to kill you, you know, but
you're like a speculative weirdo, like, I don't know, George Bataille is better on this than a lot of the anarchists are. But you're right. So all you're saying is the commodity and debt arise at the same time. The creation of a debt relationship creates a commodity relationship just by existing. Like, I am now extracting surplus.
I mean, if some, you know, slaver, you know, you were some hunter gatherer and you were, you know, enslaved, and they said, now you're going to, you know, you're in debt to me, give me X amount of goods, you know, it's like those goods are no longer for your personal consumption. They're being exchanged. You might not get anything in return besides your life, but I mean, I can still see how that would be the germ of the commodity form, you know?
irrelevant that Marx was basing his chronology off of Smith, right? Like, on like liberal contractarianism. What else could it be based it off of? It still doesn't change the point, so that we can dismiss that critique right away. One that is harder to deal with is the MMT critique, and then there are the Marxist MMTers, and I'm friends with one, and I don't know how they exist, but we argue about this all the time, that say liquidity is value. How would capital... Well, they don't say that, but they act like... Okay, 99% of MMT is actually pretty much Keynesian economics, and the 1% it isn't is this thing about currency that seems to imply that you could socially produce value by endlessly stimulating liquidity, particularly if you can knock out, if you can really separate money from its commodity function on an international market. Why is that wrong? Not economist. Why is that wrong?
In terms of a crisis, I don't think that the issue is so much the amount of money that's being passed around so much as unsellable goods.
So it's a matter of commodity and or wealth, right? I want to get our category straight here. So unsellable goods is thus what stores of value.
That right, can't so be commodity capital. It can't be realized. In the form of money capital, because there's no need for it. They were produced under, you know, probably speculative
bubble, you know.
Oops, you know, and you know, so if
also thus can't be realized in terms of use value because it'll just sit and rot.
Exactly, and so that capital is stuck. It falls out of circulation. And even if you put more money into the system, the money's just going to be devalued instead of adding more value to it. I would say that it's spreading it out thinner rather than adding more overall.
Well, my thing is if you think that the amount of money is actually an indication of the amount of value, you can't believe in labor theory of value, which to be fair, a lot of MMTers don't, but some do, and that confuses me. So there's that. Now, we're getting into all this economic jargon. Let's actually try to pin this down a little bit more specifically and, like, in our concrete day-to-day lives. Because, you know, I'm throwing this out for the theory nerds out there, but I really want to sell this. Haha, sell it. I really want to sell this as important for you to understand not just what socialism is. I mean, that's great. But how capitalism actually works and how it can affect your individual day-to-day life, and then we can talk about some weird complications of the modern economy that I do think actually don't invalidate capital but do make it a little bit more murky. So let's start off with that first one. What politically right now, from reading these three massive texts, you know, and you read them alone, right? You went
I did.
The first one with a reading group and then our
no I went through the first one, second with Harvey, and then the third one, you know, I read through, what's his name? He did the Law of Value series on YouTube.
Kevin Cooney, right?
Yeah, I read his write-ups for the first half of Volume 3, and then they went away. But yeah, I mean, I'm
no
pretty
one's
much
finished Volume 3 commentary that I know of, except for maybe Ben Fine, as a side note, or Heinrich, but Heinrich is all philology and not anything else. So... what do you make out of this? And then, yeah, what do you make, like, practically, what do you make out of it?
You know, practically, I mean, I'm a communist, and I want to do my part in building a socialist movement. And specifically, I think that Marxism needs to be rediscovered in the left. And my goal...
There's tons of Marxists right now, Mark.
No, there are people who call themselves Marxists. They're Marxish. It's all aesthetic, and like I can say that because 3 years ago, 2 years ago, that was me, and I didn't know it, and I said a bunch of, you know, stupid things, thinking I was right and sounding right, but I was wrong. And whenever you're talking to the public, whenever you're trying to push your agenda, you have to come across as as if you know something. You've spent some time doing your research. You've put some effort into understanding the subject, that you can make predictions and tell people, you know, like, relate things that they see with how you theorize the world works. And we can't do that. We can't define our own categories that Marx lays out, because we don't even know they exist, because they're tucked within these 3,000 pages that no one wants to read. And, you know, I'm saying that I know what I'm talking about whenever I'm reading finances or something like that, but I've started to pay more attention to what the stock market's doing and the interest rate, and, you know, because I think that these are important things that communists should be watching, so we can build a platform that reflects the way the world looks and the way that capitalism is moving. And, you know, going back to the global warming point, you know, it's like, if we can show people that capitalism is not prepared to handle this task, you know, capitalism had trouble building railways, you know, yeah, much
or,
less.
Or roads. Say, I mean, honestly, it had, like, you had to have, like, war capitalism come in and really establish. Right. I'm serious about this. Like, consistent road systems and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the interstate system, it was Eisenhower, right?
Yeah, it's an Eisenhower, and it was a Cold War thing. I mean, there's, I don't want to sound like a high-period Stalinist Soviet defensist, but, like, objectively speaking, without the Cold War, like, half of modern American infrastructure, which capitalism right now is dependent on, would not exist. Because we...
Absolutely.
Because the capitalists were willing to, like, hedge bets and do quasi... So I'm not going to say socialist, because they're not, but socialistic like programs, as opposed to capitalist ones. And this stuff gets ad hoc into neoclassical economics about, like, you know, free rider problems and all that, and tax, but it's ad hoc. It doesn't, it's like, when you actually, like, study neoclassical economics, which I did in college, not as my major, but I actually tried to get, when I was in college and undergrad, they tried to recruit me into the economics department, funnily enough, because I was good at this stuff. But you realize that this stuff matters. Now, I do want to push back on you a little bit.
Okay.
I don't think Marxism is just a theory of economics. And I'm not saying you're saying that, but I know a lot of people get into that, like, whatever personal disagreement Andrew Kleiman and I have, the real disagreement we had on Marxism was he thought Marxism was primarily an economic theory, and I thought Marxism was a theory of history that necessitated an economic theory. And while that sounds like you're saying the same thing, it's really not. So do you get what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that it's more of a theory of the development of human social relations and the specific ways that we've discovered to make societies work. And
so with liberal,
I think the genius of Marx was seeing how it built on each other, how each, you know, how society was dependent on its history and how its developments worked out, whether they were by accident or not. And you have to understand those in order to make sense of the world.
And it does give interesting things. Like, for example, when we talk about capitalism, Marxist. Now, again, Marx never sits down and gives a 5-point definition of capitalism. But I got from reading Capital, there actually is a 5-point definition of capitalism, right? Because why is capitalism different than other societies with markets in it? You know, that thing that libertarians do where they find a market somewhere in, like, ancient Rome and, like, capitalism's always existed.
I don't think that's a problem, though. Capital has existed, commodities have existed, but that doesn't mean that capitalism has existed,
exactly.
You know?
Like, so when I came up with this definition from reading Marx and then from reading a couple other theorists, I came up with, like, the five essential things you need, or four essential things you needed, and that is a commodity relation, and those exist, commodities exist anywhere there's a market, and markets do not just exist in capital. There's free labor, as opposed to compelled labor. And free labor does not mean, like, free. It's actually kind of an irony, right? Free labor leads to a new form of chains. It's not as bad as slavery. Marx would have never thought that. In fact, his letters to Lincoln make it clear that he does not equate, you know, wage slavery with actual chattel slavery. Those aren't the same thing. Chattel slavery is way worse. Why else would he have supported the Republicans in the 1850s, 60s?
Right. But the point is that you don't have a connection to your subsistence. You you're free from the conditions of living unless you do something else, which is sell yourself.
Exactly. So you're free but compelled. Yes, it's dialectical, but you know, so is Marxism. But so you have free labor, you need proper banking and stable currency also, and you need the ability to reinvest. Right. I started thinking a long time ago about why in the early modern period, liberalism emerges. And I actually, a lot of Marxists use liberalism and capitalism as the same thing. I see capitalism as a subset of liberalism. But the reason why I say that is France, for example, tried to do a kind of modern commodity production, and so did Spain, that was not capitalist. You know what I mean? Like, Spain had this extractive, early modern imperialist state, quasi-capitalist, but they didn't reinvest anything. Okay, all forms of reinvestment didn't go into labor reinvestment to make more profits. It went into weaponry to make more extractive mechanisms. And the thing is, at first, that seems to be more profitable, right? But it's not. It collapses. One, because everybody hates you. And two, it really is, that kind of labor is inefficient. You can only make it efficient by really brutal means. And there's a natural limit to that, i.e. you will kill your labor. Which, by the way, the Spanish literally did a couple times, as did the French. I bring this up because it was that system that the bourgeois revolutions in France comes out of. It's not against a medieval form. It's against this like early modern enlightened despot form. That's still liberal, kind of. Okay, now you don't get any of that from Capital. But if you read Capital and then read the Brumaire and Critique of the Goethe Program, that's not as relevant, but it gets to parts of it. Some of Engels's writing on anthropology, which is kind of weird, and he's wrong on certain things. But you put all that together, you can start looking at this and like, oh, I see what Marx is talking about in Capital, in this abstract sort of like going through the first premises and doing a historical, like, I mean, if you read Capital Volume 1, like, he does eventually get to, like, real-world historical examples, but all the initial examples are logical. So you could deduce that. And if you see even Das Kapital purely as an economic text, or even as a critique of economics, which is kind of the hip way to do it these days, which, I mean, it is what it says it is, too, but you can forget that this stuff plays out historically in a way that can clarify things for you. So this does bring me, though, to one of the things that complicates Marxism today. And Marxists have not been well equipped to deal with it. They've dealt with it in two ways. One, by over-restricting who's in the working class to, like, the obvious proletariat, people who don't have any kind of property, including, like, property they don't really own. Like I technically own a house, but the bank owns the house, really. But also, I couldn't reproduce myself with what I own. Right. I could not survive off my own land, and I garden and stuff, but there's no way I couldn't subsistence farm my little, you know, half acre plot. So thus, you know, you can't say that I'm truly a property owner in the sense that I own the means of any kind of production, except for maybe production allowed under monopoly capital. But there's also this way of saying anyone who earns a wage is a proletariat. And if you do that,
half of the capitalist class are proletariat at that point.
Yeah, like all your CEOs are technically proletariat. The IWW hedges their bets by saying anyone who earns a wage and doesn't employ anybody. Now, there's this other Marxist habit that really gets on my nerves, is calling everything that is a hybrid form of class petty bourgeois. Like, people will say professors are petty bourgeois. How? What do they own? What are they selling on a market?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. All right. They're either a unique class form or they're a hybrid class form. And this is what I want to talk to you about. You and I used to talk about this. We did, like, you and I both couldn't figure out if we were part of the working class. We don't produce a direct commodity, but you read Volume 2 and you know that indirect parts of commodity production still count as labor, as working class, right? But we also are credentialed in a way that makes it very hard to scab on us. So I like to use the old labor term, labor aristocrat, which people think I'm using as like a disqualifying. You know, a labor aristocrat is part of the proletariat, but it's part of the proletariat that can most easily see their interest in some other sector of society, you know, not the larger proletariat mass.
Yeah, I think I'm the only communist I know at work. Most of the other people are conservative and don't believe in global warming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also talk about this, though. When we talk about the working class as a whole, we are often very dishonest because we try to go back and use that as, like, the way specific sectors work. For example, like, coal miners tend to vote Democratic, but almost all of them don't believe in global warming that I've met. Well, that,
right.
I mean, you know what I mean? And there's these regional differences, too, that really affect things. How do you think you can deal with those contradictions? I actually hate using the formal Marxist term here because it means something different to everybody else. Contradiction here does not mean like a what we call in logic a formal or a syntax contradiction. But those, like, to use like normal analytic philosophy or analytic history speak, countervailing tendencies with Marxism. And I actually think, I bring this up because I think volume 2 and 3, to tie it back in, actually is relevant to how you deal with that. And you don't get any of this from volume 1. But how do you deal with that? Like, how do you explain that to people? Like, I mean, you know, and the other things, like, why are most activist students and not workers? And I think the answer to that's actually quite simple, but we can get to that in a minute.
I think a lot of leftists, they want to either say, you know, the only working class people are productive workers, people who actually make commodities, and, you know, anyone else is living off of, you know, the proceeds of their labor.
So that means, and, like, all service sector people, the entire U.S. economy, all indirect commodity makers.
That obviously, like, that can't be right, because
volume 2 says it's not right explicitly.
But yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, unproductive workers are exploited, you know, just as well as the productive ones are.
Also tangentially productive workers, which a lot of people don't realize, like, not like the indirect line is actually very important to capital functioning.
Right. And I think that Marx shows that where he talks about how different methods of circulation or administration can actually, they can have more overhead costs, but in the end save them the money in the long run. But I think that what's important when you're talking about, you know, who's working class or, you know, who's a capitalist is, I mean, it's really just, it's their position in society, kind of as an individual, but also.
I like to think of it this way. I am a teacher. If I lose my job, I can get another job, but I couldn't just not work, right? It would be very hard for me to even turn that into like a petty bourgeois business without some kind of assistive technology I'm also inventing. So actually in the commodity would probably be the assistive technology or the medium. Unless I pulled some kind of IP stunt, right? Like, those are my options. So I at least have some sort of hybrid formation in relation to capital. So I kind of subsist into another example of this, like, almost all of us have some investment in stocks now. So we're all technically like hyper micro owners. This is one of the few things David Harvey's good on. Hyper micro owners of capital, right? If you have a 401k at all.
But is that significant? Like, whenever there's,
yeah, you couldn't crisis, live off that.
Is that gonna matter anymore, or is that capital gonna be funneled into the wealthier of capital owners, you know? So, yeah. I mean, it's on one end, it's easy to say, okay, this person is obviously working class. They own no capital. They own no stocks. They own no property. All they can do is sell their wage. You know, it's like, okay, yeah, they're working class. But then with someone who, you know, has a 401k, owns some stock, but at the same time, they live paycheck to paycheck. If, you know, yeah, just the slightest bump in the road could mess them up.
One medical bill that the insurance doesn't cover all of.
Right. I think that there isn't a good answer for who is capitalist and who is working class. And honestly, I don't think that it matters.
No, that's going to shock a lot of people. I agree with you, but that's going to shock a lot. So go ahead.
The thing is, I don't think that if we took every billionaire in the world and put them up against the wall, I don't think that capitalism would go anywhere. I mean, it doesn't matter if X person is a capitalist or not. It matters how we're able to destroy the capital relation and replace it with socialist production,
right?
And a planned economy. And so, like,
it also is true with the workers. So, like, this is why I think workerism is silly, for example.
Right. So, I mean, I'm from Alabama, and most of the workers I know, they're not supportive of socialism. A lot of people that I know that are poor are very racist. They love the mythology surrounding the Confederacy. They are poor. They live paycheck to paycheck. They're uneducated.
And there are historical reasons for that, but they're not. It's not exactly as simple as, like, oh, they're workers, they should be progressives because it's in their best interest. Well, individuals have psychological interest too. I have gotten into debates with leftists who seem to think that, like, racism is only an upper middle class problem. And yes, I think political racism is kind of an upper middle class. Like, I don't meet a lot of poor white nationalists, actually.
I do.
You do?
One of the only people that I know with a swastika tattooed on their body is probably the poorest person that I know, in and out of prison, you know.
Well, yeah, I take that back. When I think about, like, I hate to use a Marxist term that a lot of people don't like, but, like, for lack of a better term, lumping are criminal elements. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've dealt with prisons. I know about the Aryan Nation. At the same token, I don't think they're more racist than, like, say, the upper middle classes. They're just more obviously so.
Right.
As an aggregate. But I also know plenty of poor white people because they had to live in close proximity to black people who have gone the other way. Although the proximity is not always a good measure, by the way. Like, yeah. Alabama, plenty of proximity.
Yeah.
I'm from Central Georgia, I know. You know, this is where I think, like, E.B. Du Bois, you and I have had debates on him before, but I think he's actually right on the wages of whiteness theory. That there's, like, if you're poor, like, proletarian, like, kick down of anybody, having another ethnic group or racial category or some other that you at least are better than is psychologically fulfilling.
Yeah.
You know?
And so this starts to sound conspiratorial, and Du Bois says it, but I do think that at least in nearing the end of the Civil War during Reconstruction, that those ideas were consciously pushed. You know, they wanted those racial divisions to be sown, and
definitely it was by 1910 for sure. I know Reconstruction's collapse is part of it, but I think by, like, when you really see the neo-Confederate stuff explode, like all those stupid
statues,
that's all 1910, 1920. You know, it's way later than people think.
So yeah, the going back to, you know,
it was
know,
also good for union busting.
Or proletarian, or, you know, capitalist. It doesn't matter, you know. Like, you can have a government made up of working class people, but unless you make real changes towards how we produce and distribute our goods, you're still going to have capitalism, and you're still going to have reactionary decisions, and you're still going to have social ills, and
right,
you know,
right,
all right. With it. So it's like, it's not so much, you know, we have to get working people. It's that we have to develop a politic that really lays out why working people need, or how it's possible to build socialism, why working people have to do it, and why it has to be done with a post-capitalist, you know,
right,
modus operandi.
Yeah, we have to convince people, basically, and particularly in the South, that, like, there are interests that you have beyond racism. And honestly, there are. And people already get this. Like, I had plenty of hardcore racists in my life. And even, like, they would help a black person out for a paycheck. You know what I mean? And they would get over their racist crap in all but a microaggressive way. I don't even like that term, but I'll use it for here. So that everybody could earn a living. And some of them even had, like, there was some compartmentalization, too, like, that's hard to explain, that I actually don't see amongst certain middle class people who think they're progressive, but, you know, avoid certain parts of town because they're brown. And I have gotten into arguments with even people that I work with over this because I'm a Southerner. And as a Southerner, when people are like, racism is purely like a proxy for economics, I'm like, what are you on? You know, like, yeah, there's an economic struggle that it obscures, and it does come out of that, I think. I mean, like, the categories of race come out of early liberal imperialism, right? Like, almost certainly. Even, like, normal liberal sociologists and historians will agree with this. It's not, like, you don't see, like, the ancient Romans didn't, like, ancient Roman Christians, for example, didn't note that Anastasius... In fact, I've seen him listed as like a key figure of the white church, and I always laugh because he was Ethiopian. Because it just wasn't important to them in the same way it is to us. It'd be like if we had to comment on everyone's eyes being blue or something. It just wasn't... I'm not going to say it wasn't some marker, but it wasn't a marker of race, because that concept comes into being with the Portuguese slave trade. Almost right. Explicitly. Because it's a move over from the religious slave trade, when it's no longer justified on religious terms, it's justified on racial terms. So yes, in that sense, racism is economic because our racial categories come from an economic transaction. Like, we're going to be good historical materialists about that. But, like, I don't know. I even think we're going to have anti-racist campaigns, like, in socialism.
For sure.
And racism might get weird. And so, I mean, like, we already know the threats of national Bolshevism. And Marx thought about this stuff. And also, to be fair... Marx had some racial views that were not particularly progressive.
He called someone the N-word. He was called it LaSalle?
A Jewish N-word, because he was a dark complexion person of half Jewish descent, which is funny when you think about it. And this is not a justification; it's just a historical irony. Guess what Marx himself was? A dark complexioned German of half Jewish descent.
Yeah, his close friends called him Old Moore.
Yeah.
But I think that racism is just, if to use a Marxist term, I think it's been reified, and we're going to have to do a lot of work just decluttering all of the historical baggage that went into actually developing what we call racism today. Yeah. I mean...
And it's like liberal historians and sociologists, as annoying as I can find their woke signaling, are actually doing good work. I wish we had more Marxists doing it, frankly. There is, I think Verso published a good Marxist two-volume series on the development of the idea of whiteness. But there's not enough of that. Like, most of this is still done by kind of, you know, liberal or... Marxist, maybe they're Marxist adjacent sociologists and historians.
But you know, I don't think that you can really understand the whole whiteness argument outside of the story of the South. And you know, the slaves, they left their fields when the Republican armies invaded and basically joined the army and participated in a military dictatorship. I mean, that's a huge deal, you know, especially to ignorant farmers who don't know any better, you know, to hear about plantations burning and, you know, slave revolts. And even if you're not a friend of the Confederacy, and a lot of, you know, poor white people in the South weren't, because, you know, they were hungry.
Yeah, I mean, like, there were free standers. Yeah, and also were abolitionists even early. Although, funnily enough, when you actually study the history of the abolitionists, a lot of them were, like, super racist.
Yeah.
I mean, like, some of them were more racist than the slave owners, which is hard to imagine, but a few were. I was reading about this abolitionist phrenologist who was like, you know, we need to free these people because they're too simple to be slaves. And I was just like,
wow.
And I'm laughing because it's terrifying. And it's funny because I think there's a trend in Marxism. For a while, I'm one of the people, as you well know, who published that Mark Fisher piece, even though I critiqued it immediately, but on Vampires Cancel. And for a while, like, everybody was like, race even more important than class. Like, I remember the, even ISO people saying that, right? Which I thought was weird. But there's kind of been a counter trend with a workerism that denies, like, real racial issues. Or at least, like, talks out of both ends of their mouths about them. And a lot of people used to link me to it. And I think if you're a solid Marxist, you have to admit that, no, race is a historically constructed category that has some biological elements tied into it, like if you know anything about genetics. But like if you know anything about genetics, you also know that like races and genotypes don't match up at all. Anyway, yes, I could figure out with high degrees of probability someone's race from their genes, which is, you know, so racists will try to use that. Anyone who knows more about genetic drift knows that, knows differently. And, you know, Marxism wasn't necessarily great on this either. I mean, Engels's notion of world historic peoples had a slightly racial undertone, and or at least it could easily be taken that way. And there was a lot of fights within the SPD about anti-Semitism, and even Marx modified his view of imperialism over time. You know, he was almost pro, like very early Marx was almost pro-imperialist because he thought it was bringing material development to certain areas. But or later Marx realized, nah, you know, there's a problem with that. This is not to do the whole like Marx wasn't woke enough. But the thing is, if you read Capital, and to tie this back in for a second, if you read Capital and really focus down in on that, you realize that a lot of that doesn't matter. Because like, for example, if I'm an anti-racist activist, and this is something the Black Panthers understood, weirdly, if I'm an anti-racist activist, but I want to materially help all the poor people in my community. If I also pass something that's in the interest of poor white people, I can get that done a lot easier than if I try to do it on like guilt or justice reasons. Even if the guilt and justice reasons are valid, right? Like it's just a pragmatic issue. I'm trying to think of an example of that. Like socialized medicine, right? If you actually had that, it would actually disproportionately help the Black community. There's more uninsured per capita, but since in raw numbers, it would help a ton of white people, it'd be easy to do in America. Does that fix racism? No. But does that fix the material problems of a lot of Black people? Hell yes. And that's where I'm always trying to get like, hey, even anti-racist activists, look, you know, listen to what I'm saying here for a second. You're right about reparations, whatever. Don't make the justice argument. People don't give a crap. you for justice to work, people have to already accept your moral framework, and they most likely don't. So what else are you going to do to get this done? I know that's a little bit, we seem very off topic from volume two, but this is like even a practical considerations of even moderate reforms, like why you should care about this stuff. And you and I both know, well, the moderate reforms ultimately won't work. Does that mean you shouldn't push for them? No. Again, oh, you wouldn't get that from Capital, though. You get that from Marxist comments to the French Marxist. But still. So I guess the long and short of it is, read Marx. However, I am sympathetic to the argument that, like, somebody needs to do a good primer that doesn't assume people are, doesn't do that whole, like, well, pros work too much to be educated. They're all dumb. Oh, they're not. But they do work too much to know your specific jargon, right? That does require leisure time. So why aren't there good secondary sources on this? And what do you think are good? You've read a bunch. What do you think are good secondary sources?
Honestly, I don't know of any secondary sources that satisfied me. I'd read a bunch of them before I actually dove into Capital, but I never felt like I was much the wiser after finishing them, and I realized how just inadequate they were, you know, as I actually dove into what he was talking about. And it's complicated, and it's hard to read, and it would be nice if there was something better. Yeah, but I don't know if there is, because I feel like, especially in volume one, Marx really planned the way he said things and the words he used.
And it's repetitive for a reason. Yeah, it's repetitive
right.
because
he's not defining something. He's not saying A is equal to B, but he's showing how it develops over time and how it works together and how it influences each other. You know, the deeper you get into the analysis, you might not understand something from the first part until you get to the end of the book and you start to see how, you know, everything starts to come together. So I don't think that I understood part one of Capital until really I finished the whole thing, because I didn't understand value and its importance to how what am I trying to say?
You don't understand value and its importance to like how the entire system and economy works. And I agree with you. I mean, like, one of the weird things about David Harvey, he's not terrible, but he like isn't even completely sure if he believes in labor theory of value, which is like what? He hedges his bets. I used to say Kleiman's Reclaiming Marxist Capital was a good one, but it's not. And the reason why it's not is not that it's not. It is actually very faithful to this Worf material, but it's bogged down in like heterodox economics arguments that very few people know. And it's not, when I say he's not even arguing with like Main Street, it's not like he's writing against like, I don't know, like Hayek. He's writing against like Keynesians and Schaffrians and these economic schools that you could ask an economics major and they would have never heard of. So that's not, even though I think it's really accurate as to what Marx believed, at least in terms of economics. I might have issues on other non-economic issues, but I think it's pretty good on that. It's not an introduction, really. It's like a specialist text. Mm-hmm. Ben Fine did an okay introduction. Heinrich does an okay one on the philology, but he uses the philology to say Marx didn't mean things that he said, which is a problem.
Ernest Mandel's introductions to the three volumes they're really good.
Yeah, Ernest Mandel's pamphlet, he's got two pamphlets, an introduction to Marxism and an introduction to Marxist economics. One, I think, is released by Verso, and one is by, you know, an obscure Trotskyist press called Pathfinder. They're good, but they're actually not primers to Capital. They're primers to how to apply Capital. If I was going to give, like, a newbie, it's like, okay, you want something, I'd give them Mandel, and then I'd give them maybe Ben Fine.
Okay. I haven't read Fine. The thing is, though, is I don't think that this is going to be easy. I mean, Marx wasn't talking about things that were just intuitive to him. He was in, you know, the library studying for months and pulling empirical data and reading political economists that came before him and, you know, synthesizing all this data. And, you know, that's not going to be something that you're going to sit down and just pick up and read through casually. You know, it's something that you have to dedicate yourself and schedule reading times and do extra research. And it's an academic exercise. And Du Bois talks about, I don't know if I believe him, you know, 100% on it, but he talks about the sort of talented tenth or whatever. And Lenin talks about, you know, the Vanguard Party. And I don't honestly think that reading Capital is for everyone that calls themselves a socialist or, you know, believes that revolution is a good thing. I think it's for people who understand that this is a project that we have to build, and it's going to take an investment of your time, and it's not fun. It's boring. You're going to read and read and read. But eventually, you know, you'll be able to help other people go through that process, and you'll build a core of professional revolutionaries that can look at the world and build a program and actually try to, you know, move towards socialism in some real way instead of street preaching and, you know, protesting on the streets. And I think the latter is what the left wants, because it's fun, it's, you know, it's showy, you get on the news and
I feel like you're doing something. You know,
yeah, but you're really not. That's my experience. Is like I did that for a long time, and I didn't accomplish anything except for, you know, making people pissed off at me and losing friends and, you know, just wasting a lot of time.
I have really shocked people by saying that I actually don't think protesting matters anymore. I even have a historical reason for this. Before the 1940s, what a protest and a march was a show that, look, if you don't grant us these demands, we can field an insurrectionary army.
I think that's what's got everyone so scared about the yellow vests, is that they kind of are going back to that idea. You know, it's like, hey, we can do that, you know.
Well, we have the Arab Spring was sort of that, too, but And the liberal concession to that, I mean, and people forget this when they talk about Gandhi or whatever, is and Martin Luther King kind of knew this, to slightly defend King. It's like, King didn't want violence, he didn't think they should do violence, but his stuff only works if the threat of violence is there.
Right.
Like, you know, you can do this the moral way, our way, or you can do this, you know, and Ingalls even kind of, I mean, interestingly enough, when we talk about revolutionary, Ingalls really thought, at least for part of his life, I don't know if he believed it all of his life, that the revolution would be defensive. That once there is full enfranchisement, that if you had anything like a fair liberal system, that the proletariat would, if it had a party to represent it, could vote its way in, because they would be the masses of most people in a developed society, and then the reactionaries would attack that, and then you'd have to fight. So, you know, I don't know if I believe that entirely. Yeah, particularly now, but we have to remember that these people's conceptions of revolutions weren't like just some kind of punch. So when you say, and the reason why I say that is when people say professional revolutionaries, I get a little bit like, because most professional revolutionaries I've known have been LARPers, frankly.
Right. That's what I'm talking about is, you know, they want to call themselves Marxists and professional revolutionaries, but like, I mean, I don't think that they are, you know.
Yeah, the only notion I have ever really gathered for the vanguard class that I really kind of accept is that our primary mission is to advocate for space for the proletariat, which does involve, in my mind, actually doing some electoral politics, but to also remember that that's not the goal. But then the second function of a group, our party, is educational, like, and I don't even mean this in like an, you know, like we're supposed to be doing agitprop all the time. I mean, like, we literally need to be educating people. We need to be giving people skills. That's our job. And base building and all that, to me, you know, that's a very popular word right now. You know, both the DSA and the non-DSA faction of the Marxist left in America like that word. And I like the concept, but I gotta say, like, base building for what? What are you giving?
Yeah, I think they're skipping a step.
Yeah, and what are you giving the proletariat really... for it yeah. in the medium? Like, yeah, I know. Don't ask what your party can do for you. Ask what you can do for your party. But you know what? The party's got to deliver even before they're in power. What are they going to give these people? Like, some naked self-interest needs to be addressed.
And honestly, though, now the best thing that we could give people, you know, brake light clinics, they're not sustainable. We're all poor. You know, like, I have trouble paying my bills, much less funding a charity organization with all of my poor friends. But, like, yeah, I think the best thing that we can really do is...
in the top 20% of the proletariat, if we are honest, and we're poor.
Right, yeah. Like, but what we can do is we can work really hard to construct a worldview that makes sense, that can make predictions, that can give people a bit of confidence, and when they look at, you know, the world, they know what they're looking at. And but that alone,
I will say, breakaway clinics are better than protesting.
yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, what are you building towards with the breakaway clinic if you can't give people a real answer to the question they have? And that question, a lot of the time, is what the fuck's going on, and why am I so, like, poor? You know, why am I struggling so hard?
I'm gonna say it's, you know, even more radical. While I like this tenants union movement as a kind of a way to deal with unions in the post-industrial union world, and I need to do a whole thing about the difference in kinds of unions one day, because a lot of people just think they're all the same thing. But even that will have limits, and when its limits are hit, and they've been hit in a lot of places, if you don't pivot to something beyond that, they'll die. The gains will die. So, you know, you can look at the union movement in America where it's the worst, but even in places like Sweden or the UK or France, where there are real long-standing, fairly powerful unions, they can't do shit, really.
Yeah.
I mean, are what they can do is very limited. So, like, the Yellow Vest thing, and look, I'm also going to say right now that I hedge my bets on people. Yellow Vest are, I think, are a positive development, but let's not pretend there aren't reactionary forces in it, and they could win. It was the same thing with the Arab Spring. And in fact, in a lot of places, the reactionary forces won in the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
I have very particular opinions on the Arab Spring because I lived in Egypt for 2 years, but, like, I remember every narrative I heard about that left, right, and center seemed wrong to me from my experience of it. And I think that's probably true of the Yellow Vest too. There are nationalists that are going to try to capitalize on it. But any movement that we deal with right now, particularly if you don't have some kind of organizational form to channel it into, is going to be of a highly mixed character like this. And the pre-existing forms are going to be able to capitalize on it. And that was definitely true for the Bolsheviks. Like, it wasn't just they were building bases. They had a thing to exist on when a movement that, frankly, they didn't totally inspire happened, you know?
Right.
It wasn't a coup, but it also wasn't, you know, like a spontaneous uprising of the proletariat by itself, totally led by the Bolsheviks that led to the Russian Revolution. So that gets us into a whole lot of problems. I mean, it gets us into a whole lot of interesting things to think about in the future. But one of which is, I agree with you, we have to respect division of labor. But it also means that those of us who have the leisure time to do this work, because of the nature of whatever kind of work we have gives us the ability, the time to read, we should be putting that information back out there. I think we have a moral and political responsibility to do that.
Absolutely. It's been my pet project to put together, not anything in writing, but more of a, not even a lecture, but just like, I want to get people around and just talk about this stuff more often, instead of what we would normally do when we meet up and talk about revolution. I think that I would like to start, you know, holding not capital reading groups, even just like intro to Marxist political economy, you know, study groups or whatever. I don't even know, because what I've noticed is what finally convinced me that I wasn't on the right track was, you know, when Trump was elected, I thought the best thing for me to do was to go join the Green Party and to start protesting Trump. And yeah, I did that for a while, and I realized that I was doing the same thing that I was doing before, and I was doing the same thing that all the Democrats that I knew was doing. And what kind of hypocrite was I to on one hand talk, you know, like, oh, you're a Democrat, you know, like, you know, talk down to them, and then on the other hand do the same type of political actions that they were doing, and while calling myself a Marxist. And I felt like that was doing a disservice to Marxism and doing a disservice to myself, because I wasn't presenting a consistent idea, which is what I want to do. And so, I mean, the more I read, the more I realized that unless we have this understanding, we're not going to be able to make good political choices. And it doesn't matter how radical our little sect is, it's not going to go anywhere. We're not going to make any real gains unless we know what we're talking about. And we know why we make certain strategic choices. And, yeah, you know,
we know not just that we know what we're talking about. We know why we know what we're talking about, which is, I think a lot of people feel like they have the I know what I'm talking about, but if you actually ask them, oh yeah, why, they'll make some kind of weird moral argument or something. And I'm not saying that Marxism doesn't have a moral argument. I mean, ultimately it is the case that if you don't think exploitation is wrong, Marxism kind of falls apart.
But does it though? Because there's still the idea that the economy is prone to crisis. It can't be stable. The two departments could never, you know, match up in their production and exchange rates to produce harmony. I mean, even if you were okay with exploitation, the anarchy of the market makes capitalism inherently prone to destruction,
You need to read some Austrian economics though, because they actually turn that into a virtue. I mean, just to put that out there. So I think there is a place for the normative in Marxism, but most people just argue for morality. Like, they talk about greed and avarice, and I'm like, look, a non-greedy capitalist might even join your socialist movement. It might even be sincere about it. They may even be, without them thinking about it in these terms, a class traitor for our benefit. Doesn't change capitalism at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and, you know, like that one person being able to do that, or even a whole sector of them being able to do that, it doesn't change capitalism that much. I mean,
right, because they're not going to be capitalists for long. There's going to be a group of capitalists that don't have that, you know,
who replace them.
The generosity, and they'll just, Yeah.
Well, you see this when whenever a robber baron or even someone who I, you know, for capitalist is fairly, I think, moral for a capitalist like Warren Buffett, when they start, you know, putting their money where their mouth is, well, this someone just takes their place. You have Jeff Bezos and Carlos Slim and, you know, whoever else. You know, like, that's mm-hmm. how capitalism works. Yeah, there are people who might have some kind of moral responsibility to spread that wealth back out, and they may even do it. Doesn't change the system at all. And the other thing about Marxists that we kind of have to understand, capitalism is better than a lot of other systems of organization. So we should not be surprised that, like, quasi-feudal, low developmental parts of the world see a boon in the initial phases of capitalism. Like, that should not surprise any Marxist. You get more of this in the Manifesto than you do in Das Kapital, but in both of them, it's like, yeah, of course it's better. It's better to be a wage slave than a slave. So what? Like, big deal.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon accounts for additional episodes. Have a good day.